All right, why don't we open with a word of prayer. Father God, as we journey through the Pentateuch, reading about your people, it feels a bit like we are journeying through the wilderness with them. Certainly they lost their way in their time in Sinai. We ask that you would protect us from the same, that we would not lose our way, but that we would be able to see what you and what Moses intended for us to see in the text, that we would learn the lesson that he is trying to teach, that through the Holy Spirit these texts would be applied to our hearts, not just our minds, so that we would not only understand them, but that we would understand how to live them, that we would indeed believe them. That's not a task any Sunday school teacher is equipped for, but you are the great teacher, and so we ask that you would be at work. In Jesus' name, amen. So last week, we completed our journey through the book of Leviticus. It was a bit of an accelerated completion. We had to rush a bit towards the end, but spent a lot of time reflecting on chapter 26 of Leviticus as it sort of caps off the book. And it caps off the book with the reminder of blessings and curses. If Israel goes into the land and obeys the Lord, they should expect that everything they set their hand to will succeed, whether it be agriculture or conquest and expansion or expanding families, personal fruitfulness. They should expect blessing at every turn. And if they turn from the Lord, they should expect to be treated just as the unholy nations the Lord was driving out from before them. So God's covenant did not preclude Israel from suffering great harm at the hands of their own unholiness. And that in Leviticus, particularly, that unholiness is pictured as indistinction from the nations around them. Recall that we were in the holiness code in Leviticus, starting in chapter 17 or 18, depending on how you count it, and moving through the end of the book. And the whole theme of the holiness code was in response to the people of Israel wandering away from the tabernacle to sacrifice to goat idols outside the camp. So the Lord puts bounds on his people and tells them how they are to be and warns them that if they are not distinct, if they are not set apart, if they are not holy from the nations around them, from Egypt, from Canaan, from Babel, then their treatment will be the same as they go into the land. I made a statement towards the end that the end of Leviticus capped off the holiness code, and I'm going to walk that back a little bit this morning because the passage in front of us, Numbers 1 through 6, is a little bit vague in terms of which section it belongs with. Does it belong in the holiness code, or does it belong in the wilderness wanderings narrative? It's not entirely clear. You could probably place it in either. As we turn to Numbers, we're going to encounter a number of interesting time markers. Can anyone remind us of other time markers we've encountered in the Pentateuch as we've gone? Tell us what day or month or year we're in.
Well, the story of the flood was very particular.
Okay. Some time markers in the flood narrative. Yeah. So, for instance, one time marker is that we know from what had been told to Abraham that God's people were in captivity in Egypt 430 years. So there's a time marker for us. We have that Moses' return to Egypt after his exile was when he was 80 years old. So a bit of a time marker there from the birth of Moses to the time that he returned. I think we have a time marker saying he spent 40 years in Midian, although I didn't brush up on that quite enough. And then as Israel has left Egypt now, unlike before where everything was anchored in the creation account, God was always taking us back to the creation account to remind us who he was. Now the Lord, every time he states his name, he is the Lord who led you out of Egypt. And so their time markers are relative to the time that they left Egypt. We read in Exodus 19, they arrived at Mount Sinai on the third new moon after leaving Egypt. I believe that would mean the third month. You could technically call it the 2 months after. If they left on a new moon, then you'd have one and two. But one way or the other, 1 to 2 months after leaving Egypt, they arrived at the foot of Mount Sinai. And recall that that's still where they are. That was way back in Exodus 19. That was too many chapters to count ago, I think, for 48 chapters ago. And we've got another 10 chapters to go before they leave Mount Sinai. So they've spent quite a lot of time at the foot of Mount Sinai. That's where, of course, the worship of the golden calf had occurred, and the Lord's responsive giving of the priestly code, showing how he would be worshiped to the people. Towards the middle of the priestly code, as the tabernacle is being constructed, we read of a census being taken in Exodus 38. Recall that the instructions for the tabernacle in Exodus 27 or 28 had said, every time you take a census, you're to take a collection. Every person is to give this specified amount, and that's going to be for the continued operation of the tabernacle. There had been a free will offering for the construction of the tabernacle, but now there would be a continual, almost like a mandatory tax to fund the operation of the tabernacle. And at the end of Exodus, the beginning of chapter 40, verse 1, we read that it is the second year after leaving Egypt, on the first day of the first month, that Moses assembles the tabernacle and begins the process of consecrating it. That story, that narrative, of course, extends in all the way into Leviticus chapter 10. So we've got our time markers there, and our time markers are about to get a little confusing. We are very committed to, well, I don't know, I think I'll walk that back too. We're accustomed to stories normally following chronological order. It's easiest to understand a story when it's told in chronological order. And yet, the author of the Pentateuch, Moses, in this case, is going to give us a very clear indication that he is not telling the story chronologically. It's not just events that we can't reassemble. Like, I don't really understand, why did he say this? And then he goes back. And that's not really, sometimes we have that in Scripture and we say we think that this was told out of chronological order. For instance, Exodus 38. That census doesn't seem to have been taken before the first day of the first month of the second year, the 1 year anniversary of leaving Egypt. In this case, Moses is going to call out the time markers for us. We're going to start in Numbers 1:1. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. So 1 month after Exodus 40, you could say that in that sense, the book of Leviticus lasted a month, all 27 chapters there. However, if you look to the diagram in your notes, you'll notice that the timeline gets a little twisted from there. In Numbers 7:1, we go back to the first day of the first month of the second year. So we're going to go back to the timeline of Exodus 40, and he's going to tell some of that story again from a slightly different perspective and with a different purpose. As we get to Numbers 9:1, recall that in, this is a long time ago now, but as we completed Exodus, we said one of the reasons for the hurry to get the priestly code all written down is we're in the first day of the first month. On the 14th day of the first month was to be the Passover feast, the first time celebrated outside of Egypt. So they need a consecrated tabernacle. They need a consecrated priesthood. They need all of this to be operational for their practice of the Passover feast. And in Numbers 9:1, from Exodus, we've been waiting since Exodus 40. Finally, in Numbers, sorry, not is it 9? Yeah, 9:1, we get to the Passover feast on the 14th day of the first month. We're also going to hear in Numbers 9 about, we're not going to get there this morning, but about the 14th day of the second month. There's a, you might call it a do-over Passover for those who were caught unawares and were unclean, ritually unclean at the time of the first Passover feast. God establishes an opportunity for them to participate the following month in effectively an identical feast on the 14th day of the second month. And then by the time we get to Numbers chapter 10, in Numbers 10:11, we're on the 20th day of the second month of the second year, and Israel sets out from Sinai. And from there, it would seem that the story flows somewhat chronologically. So this is not a massive reordering of events that we're seeing here, and yet it is a significant reordering of events that Moses is drawing our attention to. So we've come across things like this in the past, in the Pentateuch, and we've kind of exercised those muscles of what do we do with texts like this that seem to get everything rearranged. Certainly, there are a number of ways that scholars interpret this. What do you all see? What do you think we ought to be looking for as we encounter rearranged narrative?
Remember. Remember this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been 48 chapters since some of this stuff has been told. We may need a refresher on some of it if it's necessary for the story moving forward. Very true. Anything else to look for? Yeah, Aaron.
I think oftentimes you find in that repetition the slight differences between the accounts are kind of the focal points of, you know, pay attention to this different, slightly different perspective that you get.
Yeah. That's right. Linnea, did you have something to add too?
It might show patterns.
Yeah. I think that's correct. I think that, you know, what Salehammer's main principle has been, and of course that's the primary author I've been using in understanding these texts, his point is always that when we encounter these surprises, we're not to assume that the surprises are accidental. That's, of course, the high critical approach to the text. Oh, look, clearly these are just different accounts that Moses stitched together. You've got a bunch of different authors putting together the Pentateuch. It's a composition. And instead say, what if this is intentional? What can we learn about the intent of the author in reorganizing these events, in retelling them in different ways, in calling them to remembrance? And so as we go through the book of Numbers, I'll invite you to look for intentionality. How are these things being organized and why? As we retell the story of the consecration of the tabernacle, what's different and why? What's the point this time that we're to learn? Because it's not just the same words copied over and moved forward. There's a different point to the story this time, the same historical event with a different purpose in the narrative that we are to see.
It kind of reminds me of kids as they're running science. You might do that volcanic experiment when you're this age, but by the time you get to this age, you're writing the chemical composition. You know, it's like there's always something new to
Yes. Yes, there is more to uncover, and Moses sees more significance in the history of Israel for us to dig into as we go. I'm not going to read through, but I've provided you with a topical overview of Numbers. This is just sort of looking at the chapter and saying roughly, here's what the chapter seems to be about on the whole, or a group of chapters together. It's roughly how we're going to move through the book together today. Lord willing, we'll cover chapters 1-6. Next week, we'll get up through chapter 10. Then 11-14. By the way, we are on target for finishing the Pentateuch at the end of the year, even with a planned absence that I have in the month of March, and taking the week of Easter off, of course. We need to continue at a pace of about 4 chapters a week on average. Of course, there will be some chapters we take an entire week just for one chapter, and there will be other times where, Lord willing, we can move a little bit more quickly as we go, but we are, in fact, on pace, which I was happy to find out. I was a little bit worried. I did want to point your attention, though, while we're not going to cover exactly all of the topical overview of Numbers, Salehammer has a very interesting literary structure to Numbers that he has seen that you can find on the back. And effectively what happens is we're going to get that story of going into the wilderness, the structure of the story that begins in Exodus chapter 15. They journey 3 days into the wilderness before there's complaints about water. Then they murmur, of course, against Moses. And we have manna and quail mentioned. Then all of a sudden, recall at the end of chapter 16, there's a strange reference to throughout their 40 years in the wilderness. And we sort of talked about how you almost get the sense that all the characters in the narrative look at the camera and go, what did you just say? The 40 what? It feels like an out-of-place reference, but it actually follows this very precise structure. Then water from the rock, Exodus 17. We get a commentary of Joshua being the next leader, and then battle with Amalek. And then we get the introduction of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, who provides wise counsel on how to structure the judgments of Israel. The Sinai narrative has been quite long, and we're coming to the end of it. He has it going through Numbers 20, but then he doesn't later on. I think that's meant to say Numbers 10. I think that's a typo on his part. But then immediately after the Sinai narrative, as Israel moves out in chapter 10, we're going to hear about Hobab, which seems to be another name for Jethro. Same person, going to once again provide some wise counsel as to how to make their way through the wilderness towards the promised land. As a Midianite, he would have been familiar with this land. Then we're going to hear about traveling 3 days' journey before Israel begins to murmur. God provides manna and quail. Israel is promised that they will be in the wilderness now for 40 years as the first generation dies out. Moses is told to bring water from a rock and eventually strikes the rock and receives serious consequences for his disobedience. The next leader of Israel is focused on as not as Joshua in this case, but as Eleazar, carrying on the priestly line of Aaron. And then there are battle with the Canaanites, or you might say the locals, to sort of draw. So you can draw, if you want, lines on this from the left side to the right, showing the connection of the narrative. It's the same story, just retold. The story of going into Sinai is the story of going out. The disobedience that we saw in preview going into Sinai, we're going to see in spades on the way coming out. And it's going to result in great consequence and sin and death for God's people. So that brings us to the question of where chapters 1 through 6 belong. We've not had any of our major markers of the Pentateuch. When we started this class, we said that poetry marked out the structure of the Pentateuch, starting in chapter 1 of Genesis. I can't quote it from memory. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27 is male and female, he created them. In the image of God, he created them. And then there's an appendix, a little narrative suffix at the end of chapter 1. Chapter 2, likewise, Adam says, "This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken from man." It's a poem followed by a narrative appendix by Adam. Chapter 3, the concluding poem, of course, is the curse that brings blessing. From the Lord, followed by the narrative appendix. Once again, it's Adam saying, "Wait, did you just say we're going to have children? She shall be called Eve, for she is the mother of all of the living." And so over and over again, the larger the poem, the larger the section it's capping off in the Pentateuch. We encountered the first, what we would call major poem in Genesis chapter 49, the Song of Jacob, as he blesses his sons in Egypt. And that sort of caps off the Genesis narrative. It's followed by the suffix or the postscript. You know, there's a lot of words we could use to describe that, of chapter 50 of Genesis. Then the next section begins in Exodus 1 and is capped off with the Song of Moses in Exodus chapter 15 as they're on the far side of the Red Sea. I know a number of you have taken the time to memorize that, and I hope it's been a blessing to you. I know it has been to me. That narrative is followed by the suffix of Miriam leading the people in worship using the Song of Moses. In some cases, because of that, it's called the Song of Miriam. But since Exodus 15, we've hardly had any poetry whatsoever, let alone a major poem to mark off a section of the Pentateuch. And so it's a little bit difficult to draw lines definitively. The holiness code seems to be coming to an end, having ended with Leviticus, or maybe is coming to an end here. We'll see in chapters 5 and 6 before long that the laws seem to fit with the holiness code in chapters 5 and 6. They're laws for the people of Israel, how they are to behave in their time in the wilderness as they are journeying through. And yet, we also will see in chapters 1 through 4, we're very much back to a narrative structure, which is sort of out of character with Leviticus. Hasn't really played a large role so far in the Holiness Code. There was a brief narrative at the end of chapter 24, and that's been all we've had so far. So it's a little bit difficult to say precisely which section this text belongs with. It is certainly transitional, and that's something we should keep in mind as we go this morning. With that being said, we're going to be reading only from chapters 5 and 6 this morning. Chapter 1 of Numbers is another one of those notorious chapters for getting stuck in your reading. I'm assigning homework each week so that hopefully you're familiar with the text by the time you come. Once again, my intention is not to state that a text is not valuable, but we do have to focus our time together in class. Numbers chapter 1 is all about numbering, and so I'll read verses 1 through 3. "The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tent of meeting, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, 'Take a census of all the congregation of the people of Israel, by clans, by fathers' houses, according to the number of names, every male, head by head, from 20 years old and upward, all in Israel who are able to go to war. You and Aaron shall list them, company by company.'" So from this passage, we get the Hebrew name of the book, which follows very much the same rules as some of our older hymns in the Trinity hymnal. You simply take the first few words of the book, and that is its name. So the name of the book of Numbers in Hebrew is, "And the Lord Spoke." Doesn't necessarily tell us a lot about what happens in the book. And so when the Septuagint was translated, they didn't carry that name forward into their translation. They did, like in the case of the book of Genesis. In Hebrew, it's Bereshit. That's the first word of the Bible, the beginning. And so the Greek Genesis means beginning. In the case of Numbers, rather, they sort of take a topical guide. Well, there's a lot of censuses that happen in the book of Numbers, so we're going to call it the book of Numbers. And that, of course, the Vulgate and now the English translations follow that tradition. Over and over again throughout this chapter, as we survey each of the tribes of Israel, we hear about the leader of their clan. That's going to become very important as things go on. Each tribe has a leader that is going to be held responsible for their tribe. And we hear over and over again, these are the generations. It's been a long time since we've run into that word used in that context. All throughout Genesis, we heard about the generations or the Toledot. It usually went alongside a poem. Not always, sometimes they get a little bit farther separated, but often the generations of heaven and earth in chapter 2 are followed by the poem of Adam. So we haven't heard these are the generations in quite a long time, but the word has not been absent. All throughout the priestly and the holiness codes, and I think even back into the covenant code in chapters 21 through 24, we've been hearing throughout your generations. So that toledot, generation word in Hebrew, has been present, but it's been focusing on these are the laws for throughout your generations. Looking on to the distant future, these laws are for you and for your children and for your children's children. Now the focus comes back once again, not to their future, but to their past. These are the generations of each of the tribes of Israel. And so we're getting a little bit of a hint, a little bit of a ringing in the ear that maybe that structure that we came to expect of toledot and poem and appendix, maybe we should get ready for that to be restored. We've taken quite a long break from it, but we're beginning to expect that it's coming back. And the last time we heard the word generations used in this kind of context was Exodus 6. Interestingly, the generations of Levi are listed there. I think Andrew just preached that a couple of weeks back in the service. It covers the lineage of Moses and Aaron from Levi. And interestingly, we don't get the generations or toledot of Levi in this text. He's left out. There is a census taken, but it's different from the census taken for all of Israel. So Levi's census has already occurred because we needed that in context to understand the story of Moses and Aaron leading Israel through the wilderness, Moses' selection. But now we're going to focus on the other tribes and see what has happened to them in the meantime. So the census is taken, it's called generations, and at the end they find that there are 603,550 men of fighting age in Israel. I'm not going to cover the individual tribes except to say that you can see that Judah is the largest. All of that blessing that was previewed for Judah back in Genesis chapter 29, the fruitfulness of everything he touched, his crops would be blessed, his herds would be blessed, the fruit of his loins would be blessed. All of that we see being fulfilled in that he is the most fruitful tribe in Israel. And it should not surprise us then that the second most fruitful group, if we do a little bit of creative math, we take the two tribes coming from Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, we add them together, they are just shy of the number that Judah has, which again is reflected back in Genesis 49. The second most significant blessing in the text goes to Joseph. So we see the fulfillment of the Lord's word there. And of course, the Levites are omitted because they're not fighting men. They have other responsibilities. They're also not going to inherit the land. So the two sort of purposes of this census are not for the tribe of Levi. In chapter 2, Israel is instructed, I guess I should pause there. I've been talking for a long time. Questions before we continue on to chapter 2? All right. I suppose I should have figured that with a census. It's not going to generate a great deal of conversation. Chapter 2, Israel is instructed on how to march in battle array. Oh, I guess it's helpful to reflect on the census, and as we come into the marching, some of the laws have seemed weirdly specific and maybe over-indexed on, explained in really great detail. But if you've ever tried to organize a group of 603,550 men, you're going to need some rules. You're going to need some things that you can communicate to leaders, that they can communicate to their sub-leaders, to the sub-sub-leaders, and out to the people. Otherwise, things are going to fall apart. There's not even a way for them to begin marching at this point. They've been completely disorganized and in disarray, and in a sense, the law is given to provide structure. That number of fighting men, of course, does not include women or children. It seems reasonable to expect that they probably had more than the American dream of 1.5 children per household. So you're looking somewhere upwards of 3 million people in the wilderness, all of whom need to be taught God's law, all of whom need to know how to work in harmony together and to invade Canaan as a military. They need structure for how that's going to work, and so they get specificity in terms of how they are to march. Each of the tribes is organized on its own, and they're grouped into sets of three around the tabernacle, to the east and the south, the west and the north. And I named it that way because the east, of course, is very prominent in our narratives. Adam and Eve were sent east of Eden. Blessing is regularly expected to come from the east throughout our narratives, and it's no surprise that the first tribe, immediately to the east, at the entrance of the Tent of Meeting, just behind the priests, is going to be the tribe of Judah, where we expect our hope to come from in the narrative. This sort of structured, organized, disciplined marching is set in direct contrast to one of our very recent narratives in terms of narrative timeline. Recall that we're only a little while past the narrative of the golden calf, where Israel was pictured in chapter 32, verse 15, as breaking loose. The people broke loose. Another way to translate that is running wild. They were in complete disarray. It's a phrase in Hebrew that's also used to describe mangled hair, like a dreadlock. It's a mess. It's unruly. It's unkempt. And now we see this unkempt people staged by their military groups, by their clans and families, with organization and structure and in obedience to God's law. Chapters 3 and 4 turn our attention to Aaron and Moses. And I should have called out a verse to read here. These are the generations of Aaron and Moses at the time when the Lord spoke with Moses on Mount Sinai. So now we're not talking the generations of Levi, as in Exodus 6, but we're zooming in on his descendants, Moses and Aaron, and understanding their generations. And it begins, like Numbers 1, with a census. Moses and Aaron are to bring the tribe of Levi near. Thus far in the narrative, we've heard a great deal about the priestly code, which was for Aaron and his sons, originally 5, and now after Nadab and Abihu, 3 men out of the 600,000 of Israel, plus however many are of Levi. I think we're going to read here, it's 8,000. 3 of them have been the focus of dozens of chapters of legal matter. We've heard that the other tribes are going to inherit, that the other tribes are going to have military conquest. And so for the other 7,997 Levite men, you've got to be wondering, what about me? If I'm not going to inherit any land, how am I going to eat? The priests get the sacrifice, the people get the land, and I'm just sort of stuck in the middle here. And so in chapter 3, we get responsibilities, and chapter 4 as well, for the other families of the house of Levi. And it's very interesting the way the Lord structures this. In verse 12, he tells us, I have taken the Levites instead of every firstborn of Israel. So recall that with the Feast of Passover was instituted this idea that every firstborn male belonged to the Lord. The Lord had taken the firstborn of Egypt, and he had claimed the firstborn of Israel. Because he had passed over them and shown them mercy, they belonged to him. And we reflected that we never saw that practice really carried out in Israel's history. Of course, this is why the Lord claims Levi in exchange for the firstborn. We saw this begin to happen. Of course, we've sort of anticipated it. The book of Leviticus is about the priests. It's not about all of Levi. It's about only three people out of the tribe of Levi. But so we've anticipated this, and it's been part of the narrative since as early as Exodus 32. Recall that after the golden calf, when Moses comes in to carry out judgment against God's people, he calls the sons of Levi to him and tells them to wander through the camp, striking whomever they find. And I don't recall the number of Israelites who died in the wilderness on that day. And the Lord is pleased by this action. And in verse 29, he says, I have chosen Levi for myself. And now that sort of that choice of God is being formalized and explained in legal terms. He is taking the sons of Levi in lieu of the firstborn of all of Israel. And the sons of Levi are not quite as many as the firstborn of Israel. They're a very small tribe compared to every other tribe. And so when all the census is taken of all the firstborn of Israel, it finds that Levi is not a fair trade. There's something missing in this transaction. And so the redemption price, recall that the firstborn of Israel could be redeemed, that he belonged to the Lord, but that the parents were to redeem him from the Lord with a certain price. The redemption price for the difference between the tribes of Israel and the men of Levi and the firstborn of Israel, the redemption price is collected from the people and paid to the Lord in order to redeem the firstborn. And then in verses 17 through 39, we get the list of the clans of Levi and their duties. Levi had three surviving sons, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. To the tribe of Gershon was given the draperies of the tabernacle. Think all of the tent fabrics and things like that that needed to be collected up. That would have been among the first things that needs to be collected up. And then to the tribe of Kohath was given the instruments of the tabernacle, the table of showbread and the lamp and the altar of incense, probably also the things outside the tabernacle proper, like the laver and the altar of burnt offering. They were to be wrapped up by the priests. Only the priests could interact with them directly. So they're packaged up in a sense with goatskins covering them and poles to carry them. And then it is the tribe of Kohath who is to come and retrieve them and carry them throughout their journeys. And then lastly to the clan of Merari is given the poles of the tabernacle. Recall that we have, 75 feet by 150 feet with poles every 10 feet or something along those lines to hold up, and then cross poles to hold up just the walls around the tabernacle. Then the tabernacle proper had its own set of poles and cross beams, and all of these things needed to be maintained. And so that would have been the responsibility of the tribe of Merari. To Aaron's sons is given special responsibility in verse 38. They are guarding the sanctuary, interestingly, to protect Israel. They're not there to protect the tabernacle. They're there to protect Israel from accidentally breaking forth on the Lord like they did in previous chapters, like Nadab and Abihu had, in a sense. They are there guarding the sanctuary in order to protect Israel, and any outsider who came near was to be put to death, in verse 48. I told the story a little bit out of order. Sorry, verses 40 through 51 cover the redemption money for those that are lacking in the tribe of Levi. And then chapter 4 gives us very detailed instructions around how the packing and unpacking of the tabernacle was to occur. All of these things were to be done in the way that the Lord prescribed. We had already seen men die for approaching these things inappropriately. If you're the tribe of Kohath, responsible for carrying the mercy seat, you want to know precisely how God intends for you to do this thing, which you have just recently seen two men incinerated for doing. So the specificity here is a mercy to these clans. And so that covers the majority of chapter 4. Once again, even coordinating 8,580 men, the men of the tribe of Levi, requires a lot of specificity and instruction and organization. And so that's what we see here in the book of Numbers, a well-structured people. And verse 49 is sort of emblematic of the entire passage. It says that everything was done according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. They were listed. That according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses was a recent emphasis in the construction of the tabernacle. According to everything that Moses said, so Israel did. Once again, we're zeroing in on Israel's obedience. They're having their moment. They've really struggled to get it together in the wilderness, but throughout this passage and into next week's passage, we're going to see Israel obeying God. a well-disciplined military nation ready to obey God in conquest of the promised land and in obedience to his law. Of course, that story will not extend past chapter 10, but we can enjoy it while it lasts. That brings us to chapters 5 and 6. Now, I hope I can ask the person with reading A to read Numbers chapter 5. Oh, did you have a question? No? Was there a question I missed somewhere?
I wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, Mark.
So you have the tabernacle and 3 tribes on the east, 3 on the west, south, and north. And when you visualize that, that's a cross shape. And people criticize Christianity because they say, oh, you got the cross and Roman executioners. No, the cross is throughout the Bible before the Romans ever had their empire.
Yeah, it is a shape of 2 crossed bars. And with Levi also to the east between Judah and the tabernacle, you even get one side slightly longer than the others with 4 tribes instead of 3 to the east. That's right. Any other questions or comments before we turn to... Yeah,
Tom. It's kind of trivial, but it's curious to me that when they counted up the Levites, they were all an even number. Usually, maybe the tens or the hundreds even, but when they counted the firstborn, it was a very particular number, and I just kind of wonder why it would have been done that way, and you end up with 273, a very specific number of these sort of overings that need to be redeemed.
Yeah. It almost feels, I can't give specific commentary there, except to say that it almost feels like when it comes to paying back God for the redemption price of the firstborn, they're not willing to round. they've seen the what happens to those who are drawing near inappropriately, and they're not willing to do that anymore. But beyond that, I don't know. It does seem, these censuses are all said to take place in a certain day. That's a time marker to the narrative, not necessarily to say that within a 24-hour period, 603,550 men were counted. While delegation was done, and that would create the capability for us to, take sums and sums of sums and sums of sums in a nice little, almost early computer science algorithm, you might say, in order to get the total for all of the tribes. They're doing some parallel computing there. Nevertheless, it's likely that that wasn't all done in a single day, that this was a period of time that they were doing this work over. All right, let's turn to chapter 5. Thank you.
The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel that they put out of the camp everyone who is leprous or has a discharge, everyone who is unclean through contact with the dead. You shall put out both male and female, putting them outside the camp, that they may not defile their camp, in the midst of which I dwell. And the people of Israel did so, and put them outside the camp, as the Lord said to Moses, so the people of Israel did. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. When a man or a woman commits any of the sins that people commit by breaking faith with the Lord, and that person realizes his guilt, he shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it and giving it to him whom he did the wrong. But if the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord through the priest, in addition to the ram of atonement, with which atonement is made for him. And every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his. Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel. If any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him, if a man lies with her sexually, and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, since she was not taken in the act, and if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife who has defiled herself, or if the spirit of jealousy comes over him, and he is jealous of his wife, though she has not defiled herself, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest, and bring the offering required of her, a tenth of an ephah of barley flour. He shall pour no oil on it, and make no frankincense, and put no frankincense on it. For it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance. And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. And the priest shall set the woman before the Lord and unbind the hair of the woman's head and place in her hands the grain offering of remembrance, which is the grain offering of jealousy.
Thank you. So verses 1 through 4, we see Israel not only once again instructed to put the unclean among them out of the camp, which they had already been instructed in Leviticus chapters 11 through 15, particularly chapter 13, but now we see it also carried out in narrative form. We see Israel, once again, the emphasis here is Israel is doing what the Lord has commanded. In verses 5 through 10, the Lord sort of clarifies something that we don't even have in our nation in terms of Western law. That is, when treachery is done and a debt is owed for that treachery to be paid back, so to speak, it doesn't matter if the victim can't be found. It doesn't matter if the victim has passed away. The treachery can be paid back to the Lord. Because sin against one's neighbor is not just sin against one's neighbor, it is ultimately sin against God. And so, whether a victim makes a claim or not, that sin is to be dealt with among God's people. So it's sort of a unique law, different from the tort law that we have in the West today. And then verses 11 through 31 are among the most difficult passages of the Pentateuch to approach. And because they're so difficult, I'm going to phone a friend and just read you what Sailhammer has to say on the topic. I have a handful of notes. You're going to have dozens of questions. You're free to ask them. Know that I will be incapable of answering most of them. The case of the jealous husband is a curious one that raises many questions about the nature of social relationships in ancient Israel. This passage, however, does not give enough information to allow even a sketchy reconstruction of the details of this ritual. Since the text has given us so little information, we should be careful not to read too much into the practice described here, especially on the basis of magical practices in primitive cultures from our own day or from the ancient world. Rather, we should attempt to understand what the writer has given us, not what has been left out. We should also note that the writer of the Pentateuch seems little interested in such details and more concerned with the larger theocratic lesson embodied in this specific law. In other words, in this particular case, law is included here because it gives another illustration of God's personal involvement in the restitution for the sin of the nation. Within God's covenant with Israel, there could be no hidden sin among God's people, nor any hidden suspicion of sin. In the previous case, verses 5 through 10, when a man or a woman wronged another member of the community, they were to confess the sin and make restitution. But what happened when there was no confession? What happened when there was only suspicion and no witnesses? Did this mean that the sin could be allowed to fester in the hearts of the community and go undetected? The law of jealousy shows that through the role of the priest, God was actively at work in the nation, and that no sin of any sort could be tolerated among God's holy people. There are a few notes that I can share, things that we can say about this passage. The thigh that wastes away is a euphemism for reproductive organs throughout the Old Testament. That's used in the story of Abraham, for instance, as he tells his servant, whose name escapes me, to put your hand under my thigh and swear an oath. It's a very personal gesture that's happening there in that case. And here it's picturing some sort of disease of reproductive organ that would be obvious to the people experiencing it. The water that brings the curse is mixed with the dust from the floor of the tabernacle. We've heard dust and curse in very close proximity in the past. Of course, in Genesis chapter 3, as the serpent is cursed, "Cursed be you above all livestock. On your ground, on your belly you shall crawl all the days of your life, and you shall lick the dust of the earth." So there's some sort of connection being drawn back to the curse here, at least literary connection, in terms of the water that brings the curse being filled with dust. The curse poses no threat to the innocent. Those who have not violated God's law drink the water of bitterness and are fine. It almost seems to be, maybe it's ordinary water. That phrase bitterness is often connected with childbearing, bitter pain that Rebecca had. I might get the wrong matriarch, apologies. Was it Rachel?
Yes.
It's often connected with childbirth, so the water of bitterness may have been some tradition that they had. Perhaps it was bitter because of the dust that was placed in it, or the ink that seems to have been washed off in it. It's very difficult to say precisely what's going on there, but it does seem very clear that it poses no threat to those who are innocent. It's like drinking a glass of water. Nothing happens. And yet to those who are guilty, it brings a curse. This also gives protection for women from jealous husbands. In many primitive cultures, the recourse for a jealous husband is violence and divorce. And not so in Israel. In Israel, the Lord was to judge between a jealous husband and his wife. And if the Lord judged her innocent, he did not have any recourse to continue his jealousy or to act out on anger or wrath against her. So there is protection for the woman there. I think that's all I can say with any kind of confidence about this particular passage, but I think it's wise to stop and take questions. Mark?
Well, the other matter, I disagree that the thigh is euphemism for the reproductive organs, because it's used that way. Something similar to Jacob is definitely not that kind of euphemism, so I think it's
okay.
Fine. Well, see how Hammer's comments are, to me, a way of chickening out. It's not generalities. There are very specific details, and you approach the text in a literal manner, and it has details, and this is what happened. You may find it sounding like magic, but it's the Lord's doing, and you just take it at face value.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Andrew.
I don't know if this is a stretch, but you mentioned the dust from the floor of the tabernacle is, you know, being kind of tied to the curse of the serpent and the dust. But so, like, man was also created from dust, right? So, you know, is there kind of a tie there between, are you part of
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, are you part of God's people or not? And I don't know.
Interesting. There are certainly some scholars who see a connection between the dust and the promise, from dust you were created and to dust you shall return, the threat of death in the dust. But scholars do not agree on that. They're extremely divided on that particular item, and I chose not to go too far down that rabbit hole this week. All right, I think we have just enough time to read chapter 6 and speak briefly on it. If we could discuss reading B.
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dry. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation no razor shall touch his head. Until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord, he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of hair of his head grow long. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother. For brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head that same day and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void, because his separation was defiled. And this is the law for the Nazarite when the time of his separation has been completed. He shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with a basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering, And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite, after he is shaved of the hair of, of his consecration. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved, with the thigh that is contributed, and after that the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, Thus you shall bless the people of Israel. You shall say to them, The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So shall they put my name upon the people of Israel, and I will bless them.
Thank you. Very briefly, the Nazarite text seems to be discussing an existing practice in Israel. It's not establishing something new. Rather, it's saying, when you do this thing, here's the process that I'm giving you for doing it. It provides a way for not only the Levites, who had been chosen by God to be completely devoted to the Lord, but rather for the ordinary man or woman in Israel to choose voluntarily to devote themselves to the Lord for a period of time. And I love that it includes the accidental breaking of the vow. It's not a hard and fast thing. There is toleration. There is an understanding that you're not in control of all of these things. You can become unclean without any warning or indication, and there's a process to be followed there. And then, of course, the priestly blessing is just a beautiful passage. It starts and ends with, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. And so we see the purpose of the priests was to be a blessing to the people. Conversely, Israel was to find their blessing only in and through the priesthood. And I just want to take a moment to reflect at the end. The word blessing in this passage occurs extremely frequently. And of course, it occurred quite a bit throughout the book of Genesis. We had 67 references to blessing or the verb bless in Genesis, probably reaching climax in the story of Isaac stealing the blessing, or rather Jacob stealing the blessing from Isaac and Esau. Chapter 27. We've had, since we've left the book of Genesis in the 67 plus 5, so 72 chapters since, there have been 13 references. So we've really taken a break from that word of blessing, but now it's coming back into prominence in the text, along with that word generations, along with the idea of the curse and the dust. The author is subtly signaling to us, we've had a sort of discursus on the law as it interrupted the narrative matter, and we're getting back started on track of where we were going before that initial disobedience of Israel at Mount Sinai caused us to get onto, you might say, a sidetrack of a sidetrack of a sidetrack. We're getting back to the main storyline of the Pentateuch, and we're going to see that theme continued tomorrow. Any final comments as we close? All right. Well, with that in mind, and pray. Father God, we thank you for the great blessing we have from our high priest. In it, we recognize that you have blessed us, that you have kept us, that you keep us even now. That in the person of your Son, your face has shined upon us. That we have your grace because of his atoning sacrifice. That you have, in effect, smiled or lifted up your countenance upon us, and we have peace, the most important peace we can have, not with one another or with other nations. First and foremost, we have peace with you. We ask this week that that peace would overflow into every aspect of our lives and would generate peace between us as brothers and sisters. And we look forward to the day when our high priest will return and bring true peace on earth to all nations as well. Until that day, we wait anxiously. In his name, Jesus' name, amen.